It's fun to be here. I think this is actually a very diverse workshop. And move this a little lower. So the topic that I'm going to talk about is, I find, important because I believe that we are at a crossroads of imaging. There are things that we have been doing for a long time when we interpret images and then we try to extract information. But we're getting smarter at doing this, and so I think it's time to let go and jump to some advanced way of looking at images, going away from intensities and going directly to extracting information from the image to extract attributes that we're interested in. And then the question is, why haven't we been doing this so far? And I think it is because in medical science you have a great responsibility. So if I drill for oil, I may be willing to gamble, but if I have a patient whose life may be at risk, then I have to be very conservative. And the whole purpose of this talk is to tell you that it's possible to have both, you know, the best of both worlds. To have the flexibility in the modern techniques of extracting information and to have the ability to, you know, guarantee performance of your algorithms. And the key word here is machine learning. So this talk will be split into two parts. I've actually done four projects of the same style. I'll only present these two. So there's some work that's already been published about CT, extracting information about textures and using them for classifying tissues. I'm not going to talk about that. Then there's some initial work with MRI. And here I'm going to talk about microscopy, two instances, one where we look at leukemia detection in blood smears, and the other where we look at live cell microscopy. And so you'll see there's a common denominator in both of these. I know that there's pretty much, you know, both sides present here. There's the people who are interested in modeling, and I always believe that's the more difficult part. And then there's the people who are interested in collecting data and processing them in the right way. But I think we should always keep in mind that the purpose of all of this is to gain insight. And when you're in image processing, there's sort of this natural tendency to try and make pictures look pretty. And it's very hard to resist, right? I mean, when you prepare a talk, you want to make everything look pretty. But I think really we owe it to, what this is, I mean, the main purpose, right, is the insight. And that's what a numerical analyst formulated quite a long time ago, Nick Trefethen. The purpose of all of this is the insight, the information that we extract, and not whether, you know, really it looks the prettiest. And so this is today's focus. I'll talk a little bit about how you look at data and how you can extract the relevant pieces that you want to use to compare perhaps with like a population model that tells you so and so many lymphocytes should be in the bloodstream, and then you look at those guys and you count things and you try to classify them. These are the bad ones, these are the good ones. And then at the end of the day, if your ODEs are matching up with the pictures, then you're happy. So then there's a zoologist, Jim Pauley, who you know has been working with microscopes, so the modality of choice today, for a long time, and he says there's only three problems really. First, you're dealing with focus, and it's a pain. And then you're dealing with statistics, and you have to really think about it when you're deconvolving, say, what you're doing to the image. And if it's neither of those, then it's going to be a problem of biology. And so I try to stay away from biology because I don't know enough about that. I hope that our machinery is good enough so that perhaps we can just ignore issues of focus for now. And I'll focus on statistics. And so one type of statistical problem that shows up very often is the question of classifying cells and perhaps subcellular components. Because then once you have done that, you can say, oh, this is this type of cell, this is that type of cell, and maybe I like this one, I don't like this other one so much. And the relevance of this is because it's essentially the lowest level analysis you could do. Right? After you do the classification, you can look at morphology, you can look at all sorts of higher quantitative analysis, etc. But you really want to do the best you can in this first step because so much depends on it. And so there's a wish list that people who are dealing with lots and lots and lots of microscopy images could put together. And I've tried to pick their brains. So when you're dealing with lots and lots of data, you want to perhaps automate things because otherwise you'll be spending days and days looking at those. But still, you want to have intuitive controls. You want to have a dial, right? And you turn the dial and it does something that you want. But you want to understand what the dial does. It shouldn't be a parameter that you choose either to be 10 or 50 and you have no idea what the meaning is, right? So there should be a meaning behind the controls. Then the algorithm that we use should come with a quality assurance, right? In 95%, maybe 99%, or maybe even higher, it should do exactly what we want it to do. We don't want false positives, and we don't want to, you know, miss out things that are really bad. And so we want reliability and specificity at a high level, and of course there's a trade-off between the two, but, you know, depending on what your tastes are, you can choose the best possible combination of these. And so the strategy that I'll illustrate today is that you can apply machine learning techniques. Essentially, it means you pick the brains of an expert and you try to find a mathematical formulation which is flexible enough to accommodate all the things that an expert would do somehow, and then you make the machine imitate. And then you're at a level which is a bit higher than, you know, just reading out intensities and classifying things by average values plus minus something. And so the essence of all of this is that, you know, what we've been doing all along, reading out intensities, is quantifying things and then setting thresholds for, you know, where we believe things should be, and if they're outside of that, then there's abnormalities. But you can do the same thing at a much higher level, and that gains you insight. And so, as I said, there will be two applications today. One is the detection of leukemia, and the other one has something to do with tracking cells and trying to keep track of the cell cycle while looking at live cell microscopy. So let me begin with the first instance here. So of course we have to simplify a little bit, but I'll just pick out one instance and show you how to do it there. So here's how a pathologist would look at a blood smear. So you see, this is a bright field. They've been stained, these cells. So they're red blood cells, and there are these white blood cells. As far as I understand, most of them are lymphocytes. And then the easiest way to tell the bad ones from the good ones, so the cancerous ones from the non-cancerous ones, is to look at the ones that have these large nuclei and a little bit of cytoplasm, and the other thing you can do is you look at the roundness of the nucleus. So this here is a good guy, and all of these here are bad. So now the question is, how would you make a machine mimic this type of classification? I mean, how can you teach a machine to put in the arrows for you? And so to simplify things again, so that we could think of two major steps here, or perhaps three. First, we look at cytoplasm and nucleus for each cell. We say, this is cytoplasm, this is nucleus. And then we measure the ratio, and then we say, oh, this here is a cutoff, where we say that that's most likely a cancer cell. And then we visualize, because later you still may want to be able to correct for this selection principle. And so here's the idea of machine learning. How do you make the input, how do you make the dial that you want to use intuitive? Well, you spray paint. So you take an image and you have an expert sit down, and the expert says, okay, here's this, here's this, here's this. And so we flagged these two different flavors here, nucleus and cytoplasm. And then you could say, well, how does the expert, how is he able to tell these two things apart? In principle, it's very easy, right? It's by color, because these cells have been stained. And so maybe what we should do is look through color space and try to separate these two subcellular components. And you see, one easy way you could do it is by the same way we deal with our general idea of measuring things by intensities. You could look at expected value, and you could look at a covariance matrix, and then try to separate the two. So if you were assuming that these two populations behave roughly like multivariate Gaussians, then what you could do is pick these two ellipsoidal shapes here and blow them up to a certain extent so that they touch and then separate the two. Not everything is Gaussian. And so the question is there a way we could refine this type of model? Some of you have probably seen this already, so there's this idea of k-mean selection, and here's essentially the same, only with inclusion of not just the means, but also covariances. So if there's some tail here that I would like to include that I haven't done yet, what I can do is I just split my population in the direction of the longest moment of this ellipsoid, and I try to cover the rest, right? And so I can consecutively build some of these ellipsoids that cover the whole population. And what's not visible in here is that some of these will carry more mass than the others. So there are some a priori probabilities of sitting in each of these ellipsoids. And so what I've done is I've refined the model for my population by saying this is not one Gaussian distribution, it's a convex combination of several. And that's something that the computer can do fairly easily. And what I can do then is I say, oh, now grow those covariance ellipsoids to a certain point where, you could have sensitivity and specificity. You could try to optimize either of those or a combination. Let's try to be as specific as we can. And you can see that I can get roughly to 90%, 92%. Accuracy, which is not so bad. Now the question is, how can I improve that? Because I'm not happy with 92%. How can I get much, much higher? Because the human being obviously can perform better. And so the idea is that, again, you mimic what a pathologist would do, or a biologist, and you look at things at different scales. So the reason why I got into this research is the mathematics that I work with is a lot around wavelets. And wavelets are essentially just looking at images with different zoom factors. And so what you can see here is that on the right-hand side, I've blurred the image a little bit. The color variance is much less than on the left. And what an expert would do is they would look at this slide and say, oh, here's this, and then start differentiate their judgment, right? Saying, oh, here's the outline, right? By first looking at a blurry version and then picking out where the details are. And so we can do exactly that. We can move through various levels of resolution and try to place those ellipsoids in the best possible way to optimize specificity. And then I gain the sensitivity by going across scales. So right now you see at this coarse scale, only the bright red and bright green blocks are the ones that I've actually picked. But the other ones, which are shaded, I leave for future investigation at a finer scale, and I build myself around those. And so here you can see the progression. As I move through the scales, things become more detailed. I allow for more variability, but I keep the safe judgments from the last coarse scale investigation as I move along. And so I build my nuclei and my cytoplasm from one scale to the other. And so here's the whole point of this exercise. This is the data set that we've used for training the algorithm. It's tiny compared to the image that we want to apply it to, right? And we've looked at this here and we said, here's nucleus, cytoplasm, here is red blood cells. And now this image here is about, I think, 2,000 by 1,500, but I've just taken a piece out of a gigantic image, which is 10,000 by, I don't remember how many thousands. So this would be the entire part of the slide that's relevant. And that's already only a fraction, because pathologists are interested in the fringes of the blood smear. And so here's the input, and now you tell the computer, okay, now pick out, say, all the red blood cells. And the computer doesn't care how much data it is. It's just going to take it longer to do. Here they are. And then you say, okay, but I'm not really interested in those. I want the nuclei. And here's the part of the pretty pictures. I could have, you know, tuned the algorithm a little better to exclude some of these, you know, parts here, which are obviously mistakes, but I haven't done that because really I'm illustrating here the idea that a fairly simple algorithm, I mean not too advanced image processing, will get you far if you combine it in the right sort of way with these ideas of multiple scales. Here's the cytoplasm. And so now I'm ready to go to the next step. As I said, low level is classification, higher level is doing some kind of quantitative analysis of this. So again, we sat down our expert and we asked, could you tell us a little bit, you know, why you believe this or that cell may be cancerous or not? And well, there's a whole catalog of properties, and we've really only looked at one, and there's another one, the chromatin pattern, which we could include fairly easily. The other ones are a little more difficult to do, but let's see how far we can go with just looking at the nucleus to cytoplasm ratio. And so what we've done is we've implemented what's called a watershed algorithm. Essentially what that does is it just picks one cell from the other, and then within each cell it stirs the area of nucleus and cytoplasm together and asks how much of each of these do you have, right? And then you see that the blue portions here, those are the harmless ones, and the red portions are the cells that you believe are cancerous. And so once again, if you look at the classification, for example, this cell is fine, this cell is not, or actually no, it is. Oops, darn. Okay, so here's a mistake. But these cells are bad, this cell is good. And you switch on your computer vision, and it gives you quantitative information of nucleus to cytoplasm ratio. And so once you've found out the candidates for the bad cells, you can still take a second look and decide whether you've made a mistake or not. But in essence, what this algorithm will do is it will pick out the bad apples from the batch, right? And that's what you want if you have a lot of apples to sort through. Okay. To conclude this part of the talk, the main purpose here was to show you that the same type of statistical analysis that you've used with intensities, if you do it in color space, you work a little bit harder to improve the statistics. You work a little bit harder to mimic what an expert would do, meaning you go through different scales. It can go a long way. And the controls that you have, meaning the input, because you're just spray painting stuff, is understandable. You know, everyone can do that. And you would say, well, I don't like the idea of sitting down and spray painting, but really the data set that you have to put in as a training set is tiny compared to the amount of data that you're going to classify eventually, so perhaps it's worth doing. Okay. So this was the first project. Now I'm going to show you that essentially the same type of idea with, well, you know, some adaptation to the modality is going to work for live cell microscopy. So I'm really excited about this because there's actually a long history of live cell microscopy. The first guy who enabled us to follow cells while they're moving around was Fritz Zernike, and he designed some way to increase the contrast in microscopes to get away from staining, because the blood cells that we've seen in the last slide, they're done, right? Whereas here, if we want to see how a cell works, but we don't want to kill it, we have to trade in a little bit of image quality. And the reason why these types of studies are important is, well, in general, we would like to know how the gene network influences what a cell is going to do later, and in this sense, there's also some relevance for cancer. The second part is a little bit further away from an immediate application to cancer detection or to the study of cancer, but in any case, I think it still has a general importance for the field of biological imaging. So, if you want to study what cells do and how they react to all sorts of things that can happen in the environment, how they differentiate, again, you need statistics, and for statistics, you need a lot of cells. And so, one idea that's very popular right now is that you put these cells in a microarray and you monitor, you know, expression levels through different in different compartments. But the thing that we're losing a little bit in that technology is that these microarrays usually monitor averaged responses. So you'll have a whole bunch of cells and they do stuff and you measure how much they give off. And so the purpose of this project with our collaborators at McGill and OICR is to mimic, to do the same thing that a microarray does, but at the level of a single cell. So you want to track a single cell and you want to see what it does further in life and how it reacts to things in its environment. And so this again is a situation where we have a lot of data. We have our slide, we have these spots on the slide. Each of these contains, well, let's say 100 cells. You have different ways of looking at it. You can do bright field microscopy, you can do fluorescence, and you want to process all of that data in the best possible way. And so the challenge here is that if you were wanting to keep things the way you did years and years ago, you would want to look at average intensities or so, then fluorescence microscopy is a great tool. It will work exactly the way you want. There's only one catch, and that is you can put two, maybe three fluorophores in a cell, and then you've exhausted your spectral bandwidth. So if you want to distinguish between those, it's not that easy to gain a lot of information from each single cell. And so the whole purpose of this here is let's try and look at the bright field microscopy and extract as much information from there so that we can save things that we would usually do, right? So identifying nucleus by some fluorophore that localizes with the nucleus. So let's try to do that in the bright field and then save the really expensive part, you know, for gene expressions that we're really interested in. And so again, how difficult is that problem? To look at bright field images and to extract subcellular components. So here, for example, in the fluorescent channel, you see there's only nuclei and then there's these nucleoli that light up like pumpkins. And over here, it's the bright field image, and unfortunately, it's not quite as visible, but I mean, a human being could easily say, oh, here's a nucleus, right? And here, and here. But if you try to do the same thing now with it just intensity measurements, it's going to become not very easy. And so, so this has led a lot of people to focus more on fluorescence microscopy. And for example, what you can do here is you can ask, can I spot cell division by gene expression? And the answer is yes. So you see this peak here at the end, and that's exactly when a cell divides, and you can track your cells and ask the question every time, are you at the point where you're going to divide? But just compare this image here with a bright field image, and look at what you can extract from a bright field image. It's not just one variable, right? It's not just this It's an appearance. And the appearance can tell you actually quite a bit more than this single number that you're extracting out of the fluorescent channel. And so the challenge here is there a way that we can look at this and say, here's a way to quantify information in this appearance, here's a, you know, a way to tell like where we're doing a transition, etc., etc. And the answer is, or at least one attempt that we're using here is, well, just repeat what we did. Classify cells according to their components, the subcellular components, and to the stages, and see whether you can extract information about where you are in the cell cycle from that. And then later on, you can use that classification information in higher level analysis, which means you can ask, how long did it take this cell to, you know, until it divided the next time? And how long did it take the children, et cetera, et cetera? And then you have the whole lineage tree at your disposal at the end, and then perhaps you have an idea that, oh, this cell here that I'm seeing right now, later on it's going to do this, and it's going to do that, and it's going to do this. So probably it's this kind of a cell. And then you have, you know, a measure for a cell differentiation, and you can see what type of, you know, gene expressions correlate with what type of cell behavior. And so we'll just focus on cell division here. So the picture is exactly the same as before. You sit down an expert and you say, could you mark cytoplasm, nucleus, and background? And then we refine it a little more and say, okay, actually here's something we didn't do. So you could, if you wanted to, differentiate within the cell between nucleoli, nucleus, these focal adhesion points because they look different, cytoplasm, etc., and even when the cell is dividing, pick out components. We didn't do that because eventually, I mean, we made some attempts, but it would become too labor intensive to label all of these parts. So let's just focus on three things that a cell can do. So it could be, or four, it could be nucleus, including nucleoli, cytoplasm, or it could be in the stage of division. So let me just classify these different parts of the image and see whether I can automate that classification. And as you can see, so the goal would be, again, to take this picture or this picture here and say, okay, here's the cell, here's the nucleus, here's the nucleus with some nucleoli, here's the dividing cell, or actually a group of two, etc. So the problem with this is that we don't have colors, right? There's no stain. And so how on earth are we going to differentiate those? What an expert does, a biologist would do, is they look at things and they say, oh yeah, this type of feature is this. If you see this sort of diffraction pattern here, that's an indication that the cell balls up. It really rises above the slide. And then it looks like this. It looks like this fuzzy, you know, structure that we see there when it's about to divide. And so what we need to do is we need to build our own color space, which I call, or people usually call, feature vector, right? A vector which captures what's happening at a particular location. And so again, the way we do this is by looking at the image at various levels of resolution. So I'm going to blur the image a little bit with some type of diffusion. I'm not going to go into the details. And then I compare all of these blurred versions with each other, and I say, if you are like this, then I'm going to lose you at this level of resolution. If you look like that, I'm going to lose you, you know, at another level perhaps, or with at different rates. And so the different rates with which features disappear is exactly what we use to do the classification. As you can see, this fuzzy part down there is not so much affected compared to the more granular structure in the nucleus. So here I'm going to take this picture here, and perhaps what you could do is you could compare this dividing cell here with the nucleus here is about the same size of this cell on the right. And so at this stage here, the nucleus is pretty much gone, but this feature here I can still see fairly well. So that was the first part. How do I create a feature vector if there are no colors at my disposal? The second part is the part that we tried at the beginning. We wanted to annotate every possible detail, which after a while you realize is not feasible. And so the question is, can we again split distributions in such a way that the algorithm tries to find itself, by itself, the details that belong to, you know, one or the other subcellular component? For example, the focal adhesion points where the cell attaches to the slide are part of the cytoplasm, etc. Okay. And so we do this in pretty much the same way that we did before. We subdivide by first looking at a coarse scale, picking out the good guesses, picking out the mistakes, and then we look at the mistakes and say, why did I, you know, make a mistake here? Because this thing looks pretty much like that, but it is part of cytoplasm, so let me correct for those at the next level of detail. And you keep going through this. You build a tree of these means and covariances, and when you're done, you have created by yourself a model of the distribution of these features in your feature vector space. And then in the classification step, what you do is you classify all of these little details, and at the end of the day, you collapse the entire tree, and you say, this is what I really wanted to distinguish from each other. And so here's an example where you see that, so we're not yet quite as good at distinguishing nucleus and nucleoli. We have to work a little bit harder at that. But at least we can pick out the dividing cell fairly accurately from the cells which are just moving around. And so it took me a little bit to make this movie work, but I hope it'll fire up. Right. And so here you can see them in action. And as they crawl around and divide, you can spot where a cell is that's about to divide because it turns blue. Once again, we can move to a higher level of analysis, right? We can track cells as they move around. And then when the cell turns blue, we say, oh, hang on, here's the cell division. So you have to change your tracking algorithm. This is very important because what happens quite often is there's a cell that's moving around, another cell, it's coming from the fringes of your slide or of your field of view, right? And it looks like, oh, there was one cell and now there's another cell. So then the algorithm thought, oh, perhaps this thing divided, right? But it didn't. So with your classification algorithm, you have another indication that, oh, hang on, at this moment, I have to be ready to split, right? And to split the pursuit from just one cell to two cells. And that's what we're doing here. So then you can keep track of all of those cells. You know where they end up. And if you have a fluorescent channel on the side, then at a final stage here, you could say, now let me take a look at all of those cells. Let me try to characterize them the best way they, you know, I can. And then you're able to retrace them back to their beginnings. And this allows us to build correlations between gene expressions, you know, from mother to daughter, etc., all the way down the lineage tree. And so I'm almost done with my talk. Yeah, so we've repeated the same steps, right? In this example, we have built a feature vector. We've used it to extract these subcellular components that we believe are relevant. And then we can combine this analysis with a higher level step where we would say, let me try and identify the stages in the cell cycle. So here I've only, you know, flagged certain pixels blue. I could look at fractions of those, right? How much of them are turning blue, etc., and then try and correlate them with what the expert says, what type of stage in the cell cycle I am. I can use this information to build the lineage tree more accurately because my tracking algorithm has more inputs. I can monitor cell behavior, all sorts of higher level morphology, right? So for example, a cell may, before it begins to divide, it retracts all of these focal adhesion points, and I can ask, you know, how much of that process has already happened. I can use these types of morphological characteristics, again, to further classify cell types. And I could, you know, come up with a number of things that biologists would be interested in. But the essence is that really a lot of this here depends on this very first step, the first step of classifying the cells and the subcellular components. And so I hope I've convinced you with these two examples that really here there's a general principle at work. And this principle is take the very same type of rigor that you've applied to your intensity-based analysis, to the images that we've been working with for a long time, but now apply them in feature space. And then perhaps, you know, include a little bit of what a human being would do. First look at it, you know, from afar, and then try to figure out what the details are in each feature. And so if you do these two, then you gain an enormous level of flexibility and of accuracy. So the machine learning does the job of picking the brains of the expert, so you don't really have to fit parameters of sorts that are maybe not intuitive. But at the same time, it can tell you that there's a quality assurance. There's a statistical, you know, a level of security that you're operating on. And depending on, you know, how high you want to set the bar, it's going to tell you how hard you have to work. And then after this first step, you can use that information to make all the higher level analysis that you're interested in. So this is sort of the first line of attack here that you can feed into all sorts of other machines that you want to put on top. But I believe the reason why this is a nice tool is, again, because it really mimics what we would do. And at this point, we can pass the burden. When we have a lot of data, we can pass the burden onto a machine, because all we have to do is take a small piece of the type of data that we're analyzing and then tell the computer, now you do it for, you know, the huge data set, and you get the statistics from that analysis that we're after. Yeah. So I'll conclude here. Thanks for your attention.